طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح، طفلة تمتطي قوس قزح من مخيم.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to This Week in Palestine, where each week you will hear the Palestinian narrative, the Palestinian perspective, the Palestinian voice, exploring the realities of the Israeli occupation of the Palestinian homeland. You will not hear this narrative very often in the Western media, which is why it is important that it is presented each week on This Week in Palestine. This Week in Palestine was created by Sharif Pham and is continued in his memory. This is your host, John Roberts. We begin this week with a report from the Electronic Intifada, written by Charlotte Silver. It involves yet another attempt on the part of Palestinian lawyers to challenge the Israeli theft of land that has become the hallmark of the Israeli occupation. Such lawsuits have been overwhelmingly unsuccessful in the biased Israeli courts, but continue to be brought by Palestinian lawyers as acts of resistance. Palestinians will continue to challenge home demolitions, wall expansion, land theft, and in fact every vestige of occupation with all the tools available to them, including the courts. But there seems to be some optimism that this line of legal challenge might be successful. Charlotte Silver writes, "A lawsuit filed with Israel's High Court might open a new legal course for scores of Palestinians in the occupied West Bank who have had their land seized by the military over the last 50 years. Though Israel's High Court has a history of ruling favorably on expanding settlements, Dror Etkes, a longtime Israeli settlement researcher, promises the new lawsuit is a first of its kind that could trigger dozens more like it. When Israel occupied the West Bank in 1967, its military proceeded to seize huge swaths of land under various pretexts. By 1987, the military had seized 40% of the land in the West Bank, along with its major water resources. To confiscate such vast tracts of Palestinian farmland, Israel frequently invoked temporary military or security reasons. The Hague Regulations, the set of international laws that pertain to war and occupation, allow an occupying power to take temporary possession of land for military use. And once taken, access to the land was blocked to its Palestinian owners. How that land was ultimately used varied, but it frequently passed through the military's hands and became an Israeli civilian settlement. That is what happened just outside Hebron, where Israel founded Kiryat Arba, one of its first settlements in the West Bank, on a military base in 1968, and further north in Al-Baray and Dura al-Kar, where the military seized Palestinian land for military purposes, only to use it to establish the Bet El settlement. And that is the case of Akraba, a village in the north of the occupied West Bank near Nablus. Now the village is suing the Israeli state in what some hope will be a precedent-setting lawsuit. In 1972, Israel expropriated about 90% of Akraba's farmland, or 50 square miles, said Etkes, who has researched the history of the village. The huge expropriation left dozens of families who once cultivated the Fair Valley with no source of livelihoods. Aerial photographs taken on the eve of the seizure show the area was filled with cultivated plots of land. Focusing on just one parcel of the seized land, about 790 acres, Etkus has helped organize the lawsuit against the Israeli state, settlers, and quarry companies to give the land back to the original owners. This land was originally taken under the auspices of temporary military necessity, Etkus said, but it eventually formed the cornerstone of the civilian settlement of Gittit. The petition, filed on behalf of the Akraba municipality and the families of the original owners of the land in October last year, calls on the Israeli government to cancel the seizure order made in 1972, Etkus said, because there is no longer any security or military grounds to justify the confiscation. As of now, the government has not fully replied to the petition. They are biding their time, Etkus told the Electronic Intifada. They understand this could be the beginning of other similar claims. They, the Israeli military, could find themselves under a flood of similar petitions. In the first 12 years of the occupation, Israel seized about 12,000 acres for temporary military use. Nearly a half century later, the essential and urgent military needs for the land once argued by Israel have been clearly exposed as a means to settle Jews in the occupied territories. The Geneva Conventions, which regulate the humanitarian conduct and obligations in conflict, prohibit an occupying power from transferring its civilian population to the occupied territory. According to Etkus, after 1975, settlers took over cultivating the land that once belonged to Palestinian families. At the outbreak of the Palestinian uprising in 2000, the land fell into disuse before settlers began subletting it to Palestinians. Etkus noted the irony in Palestinians paying settlers to access their historic land. Over time, Etkus said, large-scale farms run by settlers have pushed out smaller Palestinian farms, and today, Akraba's land is mostly cultivated by a few Israeli settler operations. In the process of researching how the land has been used, Etkus discovered that a portion of the 3,200 dunam parcel was given over to open an Israeli quarry in 2001. It operated for just a few months and was shut down by 2002. You can see a scar on the mountain today, Etkus said, but no operation. The Shafir Corporation plans to resume mining on the location, as was revealed in the course of the petition. The village's petition argues that this violates the state's promise that it would not open any new Israeli quarries in the West Bank per the High Court recommendation in 2011. At the time of the ruling, there were some 10 Israeli quarries operating in the West Bank. These deliver almost all their material over the 1949 armistice line separating the occupied West Bank from present-day Israel, violating the international laws of occupation and human rights law. The High Court ruled that those quarries may still operate, stating Israel had the right to utilize natural resources in a reasonable manner, but recommended no new sites be opened. The Shafir Company and the civil administration, Israel's occupying authority, say the 2011 ruling does not apply to the quarry in Aqaba because it was licensed before the ruling. Furthermore, Shafir claims it intends to sell most of what is mined there to Palestinians, according to Etkes. Last year, Human Rights Watch reported that Israeli quarries sell 94% of the materials they produce to Israel or Israeli settlements and pay fees to settlement municipalities and the civil administration, which cannot be said to benefit the Palestinian people. The Hague regulations prohibit an occupying power from using the resources of the occupied territory for domestic purposes. The Aqaba petition is not the first time Israel's High Court will review the military's security rationalization for settlements in the occupied territories. Over the decades, the High Court has avoided issuing rulings that have far-reaching implications for the government's settler colonial project in the West Bank, in effect greenlighting it. In 1979, for example, the High Court argued with the military that a civilian settlement, that is Beit El, built on land requisitioned for military needs, can in fact serve a military purpose. However, shortly after, the court mitigated this ruling with a new decision on the Elon Moreh settlement. In this case, the military had tried to argue the Elon Moreh settlement served a military purpose after settlers had established an unauthorized colony on private Palestinian land. The High Court ruled this settlement did not clearly serve military purposes, leading the Israeli government to focus on seizing and declaring Palestinian land as state land for its settlements. The High Court has maintained that its decisions will be made on a case-by-case basis. This case will be important in terms of the legal strategy which we will be able to use in the coming years regarding similar cases, said Etkes, who expects a reply from the government before the next court session, scheduled for March. Now, that is a report written by Charlotte Silver, associate editor of the Electronic Intifada. But now a new wrinkle that could upset the optimism that this lawsuit has engendered. Just this past Monday, February 6th, the Knesset passed a bold new bill that would allow for land confiscation that heretofore was illegal to now be legal. Exactly how this new law will affect the current litigation is unclear, but it certainly adds a new dimension to the conflict. Freelance journalist Shireen Kalel, who writes out of Palestine, Jordan, and Israel, wrote the following article following the passage of the new law. The Israeli Knesset on Monday passed a controversial new bill that allows the Israeli government to expropriate private Palestinian land in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem, making more than a dozen Israeli settlements legal under Israeli law. The unprecedented bill passed late Monday night with 60 votes in favor to 52 against, according to Palestinian government news agency Wafa. The legislation, referred to as the Regularization Bill, legalizes more than 4,000 settler outpost units under Israeli law and has been dubbed the first step toward de facto annexation. It is the first time in history that the Knesset has imposed Israeli civil law in the occupied West Bank, which is under Israeli military and civilian rule. The sponsors of the bill said the law was an historic step toward the completion of a process that we plan to lead. The application of full Israeli sovereignty on all of the cities and communities in Judea and Samaria, according to the Jerusalem Post. Following the bill's passing, Education Minister Naftali Bennett tweeted one word, revolution. The law is in direct contravention with international law, which deems all Israeli settlements in the occupied West Bank and East Jerusalem illegal. Following the vote, international and local human rights groups strongly condemned the new legislation. Meanwhile, the European Union canceled a summit between Israel and the European Union scheduled for February 28th, according to the Israeli daily Haaretz. The daily reported that France, Sweden, Ireland, the Netherlands, and Finland publicly expressed their reservations regarding the summit, and that some countries argued that holding a meeting at this time would be akin to rewarding Israel for its bad conduct. B'Tselem, an Israeli human rights NGO, called the bill a slap in the face of the international community. The Knesset today proved yet again that Israel has no intention of ending its control over the Palestinians or its theft of their land. Lending a semblance of legality to this ongoing act of plunder is a disgrace for the state and its legislature, the group said in a statement. Omar Shakir, Israel and Palestine country director at Human Rights Watch, said the legislation reflects Israel's manifest disregard of international law. The bill further entrenches the current reality in the West Bank of de facto permanent occupation, where Israeli settlers and Palestinians living in the same territory are subject to separate and unequal systems of laws, rules, and services, Shakir said. Israeli officials driving settlement policy should know that the Trump administration cannot shield them from the scrutiny of the International Criminal Court, where the prosecutor continues to examine unlawful Israeli settlement activity. On Monday, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, PLO, said passing such a law would amount to a declaration of war. After the vote, PLO Executive Committee member Dr. Hanan Ashrari expressed concern for what the law would mean for future land annexation by Israel. Such a law signals the final annexation of the West Bank. Not only does it attempt to retroactively legalize the settlements and outposts built on Palestinian private property, it also gives clear license to the settlers to embark on a land grab in the occupied West Bank with impunity, she said. Israel is authorizing the unlawful act of land theft and its illegal settlement activities, which are a war crime under the Rome Statute of the International Criminal Court and an egregious violation of international law and conventions, she said. All settlements are illegal, whether on private property or on state land that belongs to the Palestinian collective as a whole. This also proves beyond doubt that Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his extremist racist coalition government are deliberately breaking the law and destroying the very foundations of the two-state solution and the chances for peace and stability. Xavier Abu Eid, a spokesperson for the PLO's Negotiation Affairs Department, said the law essentially legalized theft of Palestinian land, adding that the legislation negates peace and the possibility of a two-state solution. Looting is illegal, said Abu Eid. All Israeli settlements in occupied Palestine are illegal and a war crime, regardless of any law passed by the Israeli parliament or any decision taken by an Israeli judge. Peace Now, an Israeli NGO aimed at promoting a two-state solution, strongly condemned Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu for being willing to compromise the future of both Israelis and Palestinians in order to satisfy a small group of extreme settlers for the sake of his own political survival, and called on the Israeli Supreme Court to overturn the legislation. By passing this law, Netanyahu makes theft an official Israeli policy and stains the Israeli law books. By giving a green light to settlers to build illegally on private Palestinian land, the legalization law is another step towards annexation and away from a two-state solution. In light of this madness, we must act as the responsible adults and turn to the Supreme Court in order to strike down this dangerous law. That was an article written by freelance journalist Shireen Kalel. And now on to our feature presentation, which this morning is a conversation with a remarkable journalist, Remora Haas, who writes for the Israeli newspaper Haaretz. The conversation is with Chris Hedges, a journalist who has written for the New York Times and many other publications, and takes place on his RT television news program, On Contact.
On Contact. Welcome to On Contact. Today we're going to be speaking with the courageous Israeli journalist, Remora Haas.
Look, there are things that Netanyahu, of course, is different than others. I think he and the generation of today's rulers have no shame.
Neoliberalism, patriotism, truth is not socialist ideals, counterweight, class war, corporate coup d'etat, utopian ideology of neoliberalism, revolt unmasked. On Contact, Chris Hedges. Israel has been poisoned by the psychosis of permanent war. It has been morally bankrupted by the sanctification of victimhood, which it uses to justify an occupation that rivals the brutality and racism of apartheid South Africa. Its democracy, which was always exclusively for Jews, has been hijacked by extremists who are pushing the country toward a form of fascism. Many of Israel's most enlightened and educated citizens, 1 million of them, have left the country. Its most courageous human rights campaigners, intellectuals, and journalists, Israeli and Palestinian, are subject to constant state surveillance, arbitrary arrests, and government-run smear campaigns. Its educational system, starting in primary school, has become an indoctrination machine for the military, and the growing intolerance, racism, and fanaticism, which always existed on the fringes of Israeli society, have moved into the political mainstream. Anya Parampil examines the public manifestations of racism that now characterize Israeli society.
In 1948, the United Nations partitioned historic Palestine into two states, an Arab state and a Jewish state known as Israel. Israel was founded by members of the Zionist movement who aimed to create an exclusively Jewish state in the majority Arab Palestine. And following its declaration of independence on May 15, 1948, an estimated 750,000 indigenous Palestinians were expelled from their homes by Zionist militias and made refugees. The day has become known as the Nakba, or the Day of Catastrophe to the Palestinian people. In the aftermath of the Nakba, Israel passed two critical laws, the Absentee Property Act and the Infiltration Prevention Act. As part of the Zionist effort to preserve Israel's ethnic purity, the laws forbade the presence of Palestinian refugees from Israel and gave the government power to seize homes in Jerusalem, kicking families out. The goal of Israel from now on would be to keep the most amount of Jews on the most amount of land and the most amount of Palestinians on the least amount of land possible. Thanks to several military offensives and illegal Jewish settlement expansion, over the decades, the borders once drawn for Israel have disappeared, along with Palestinian-controlled land. Palestinians continuously resist this expansion, most notably during the first and second intifadas, or uprisings, the second of which ended in 2005 and turned violent as the occupation deepened and the Israeli military's tactics hardened. Under the current right-wing Likud party, headed by Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, the country has passed a slew of anti-democratic laws, including banning Nakba demonstrations, criminalizing the boycott of products from illegal settlements, and the creation of community acceptance laws, which actually allow neighborhoods to deny minorities residency. Israeli police are now also allowed to use sniper fire on child stone throwers. But considering the words of high-level Israeli politicians, perhaps these laws aren't so surprising. For example, during Israel's 51-day assault on the Gaza Strip in 2014, Education Minister Naftali Bennett responded to news of four Palestinian children blown up on the beach by the Israeli military by accusing them of, quote, self-genocide. Justice Minister Eilat Shaked has referred to all Palestinians as, quote, the enemy, and said in a Facebook post Palestinian mothers should be killed to prevent them from, quote, giving birth to little snakes. And Foreign Minister Avigdor Lieberman declared last year that Palestinians disloyal to Israel should have their heads cut off. Perhaps the current state of Israel is best summed up in the words of former president of the Supreme Court, Aharon Barak. Israel is different from other countries. It's not only a democratic state, but also a Jewish state.
There are few Israeli journalists who have the courage and integrity of Amir Ahas. She is the only Israeli journalist who has lived for prolonged periods of time and continues to live in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip. She is angered because of her uncompromising honesty, the Palestinian and Israeli leadership. The Israeli government has accused her of incitement to violence and had her arrested in 2009 after living in Gaza for several months for violating a law which forbids residence in an enemy state. Haas is the author of Drinking the Sea at Gaza, Days and Nights in a Land Under Siege. Please join me in conversation with one of the most intrepid and fearless reporters in Israel. Thank you, Amira.
Thank you, Chris.
Your awakening to the Palestinian condition, how did that happen?
Oh, that was quite early, I guess, because I was a red-diapered baby. So it's not...
Red-diaper baby?
My parents were in the Communist Party and Holocaust survivors, so it came very early. We won't start to go back that far.
But it's interesting because if you, like with Gideon Levy, another fine reporter, it really took his traveling within the occupied territories to change his understanding of what the occupation meant.
Yeah, I'm not that lucky, you know, like I was almost born understanding because I lived in I was part of a family that was, as I said, in the Communist Party, where there were Palestinian members. And we were at odds with the society around us. My father was arrested several times while I was a child. And my mother was arrested. The police came to arrest my mother because she distributed leaflets against Ben-Gurion. So it was not...
Ben-Gurion being the founding...
First prime minister. So it's for me, I must say that I'm really not quite conservative in that sense.
Well, you were fortunate in your parents, let's put it that way.
Yes, I guess. I mean, I don't deplore having been, conservative in this way.
No, I was raised in the same household. Saved me a lot of time. I just want to look at, when I lived for 7 years in the Middle East, two of those years in Israel. I was the Middle East bureau chief for the New York Times. You have that first generation, Ben-Gurion being an example, but Abba Eban, Rabin came out of that, Teddy Kollek, the former mayor of Jerusalem. Many of these people born in Europe, not Rabin, but many of these people born in Europe, multilingual, highly educated. And the question was, how do you devolve to a Bibi Netanyahu or an Avigdor Lieberman?
Or has the Zionist project always remained the same, hidden behind a different veneer?
Look, there are things that Netanyahu, of course, is different than others. I think he and the generation of today's rulers have no shame. In the times of Abaev and even Ben-Gurion, they were hiding much.
Right.
They were not disclosing all what they were doing because still they were loyal to, or at least nominally, they were loyal to a set of values that they knew that they were violating in Israeli policies. So that's why they invented, if we make fast forward, that's why they invented with the occupation this notion of enlightened occupation. There is no enlightened occupation.
Well, they also carried out the brutal campaign of ethnic cleansing,
of
the raising
course, and then
48,
and then,
which is, you know, let's face it, far worse than anything even Bibi Netanyahu has done.
Sure, sure. Only that, let's say, 48 still, I think, if you look historically...
This is the founding of the state
years,
of Israel.
Yeah, it's 3 years after the end of the Second World War. It's... you know, Zionism is seen was until then not so much adopted by the majority of Jews, and all of a sudden it was adopted by the by more Jews only when Hitler actually succeeded in eliminating a great part of the Jewish people in Europe. So the circumstances, historical circumstances, were slightly different, or not slightly different. Europe had 12 million refugees. So it was not, we're not talking about Europe that was a benign place, a great place to live. It just emerged from one of the lowest periods of time in its history. So, and there was war. I mean, you can find ways to explain it or to describe it. While 67... Actually, Israel established in 67 that it is a colonial state.
But this is when it took control of
Gaza and the West Bank and East Jerusalem.
Right.
Yes, yeah. In the other.
Well, you know that you take that great Israeli moral philosopher. Yes, who saw what everything was, but he would mark the occupation of 67 as really the end, unless Israel relinquishes the as the kind of end of Israel as a democratic or an open society. And he's been proven right.
Yes, then some would say, okay, also before Israel was democratic only because it got rid of the majority of Palestinians.
It was only democratic for Jews.
Yes, and then
always.
But, you know, the thing is that if there is a chance to change, what are the chances? What are the opportunities we give ourselves to change?
Right.
And I think that the point where Israel showed that it does not change and that it is a colonial enterprise because it has so decided was with the Oslo Agreement.
Huh.
Because the Oslo in the 90s, the Oslo Agreement gave Israel a chance to cut loose from its colonialistic characteristics.
Right. Do you think that, and because some people, Miko Peled and others, argue that Oslo was just another trick.
It was. That's exactly, but not on the part of the Palestinians.
No, on the part of...
So on the part of Israel. So when the whole world is expecting Israel, you know, now you have South Africa, it's over, and you have the end of the Cold War, it's with the collapse of the Soviet system. So there was an expectation of a change also here.
On the part of the outside world, but not on the part of the Israeli leadership.
So what Israel did is just use it in all the tricks possible to do just the opposite.
Right.
And we are talking, you know, people said Palestinians, the great majority of Palestinians, they said, okay, we give you a chance. Actually, they actually gave Israel a present. They gave Israeli society a present. Acknowledging that there was something, okay, that 48 was ethnic cleansing, as you said, but it was also the historiography of a persecuted people that found refuge in this country. You know, I'm sure that without Hitler and without the Holocaust, Israel would not have existed, or Zionism would not have succeeded the way it did.
Right.
But this is... So Palestinians actually came and told the Israelis, we acknowledge your being here, you being a society here. And then what Israel did is just the opposite, just rejected this very generous offer.
We're going to get back to that after this break.
On Contact with Chris Hedges.
Welcome back to On Contact. We're here with the Israeli journalist Amira Haas. So Amira, we spoke before the break a little bit about Oslo, 2,000-page document. But in brief, within that document, would you argue, because Israel retained control of the borders and essentially had a stranglehold on the economy, it was just a more sophisticated form of the occupation, or was there things in it that were more insidious than that?
Look, the main thing is that there is no mention of the goal of this so-called peace process.
Right.
So it doesn't state that the goal is two states.
Right.
So it is gradual. Okay, let's agree that you can withdraw gradually. But if you don't have a goal, what's gradual about it? Where to?
Right.
Then, of course, Israel maintained its control over the land, and it was supposed to be temporary until 99, and we are in 2016. And Israel has managed, from before Oslo, from 91 actually, to carve out the Palestinian territory, the would-be Palestinian state.
Well, they're taking more and more land.
Yes, and to create enclaves. So you have actually
right.
Palestinian reservations.
Right.
Gaza is the model, and then there is replicas in the West
right.
Bank,
kind of
which is important.
We should explain
yeah.
that what they've done, and I saw it on a UN map that yeah. a UN official gave me, is if you look at a map of the West Bank, It you're correct that it's kind of pod-like areas when you count the settlements, the ring
the
roads.
Which Israel controls is 62% of the West Bank, and in between you have islands
right.
of Palestinian semi-sovereignty.
And let's touch on water yeah. here because it's an issue that's often not discussed, but it's crucial.
Yeah.
Israel, which you have pointed out, they cannot justify in the name of national security, has seized the aquifers.
Yeah, they use and they impose quota on the Palestinians. They, according to the agreement, about 80% of the aquifers in the West Bank, the water, is used by Israel, and 20% is for the Palestinians, which is an outrage.
And you get whole
in Gaza,
in refugee camps, you get into houses where they don't have potable water coming out of the taps. They can't drink the
not
water.
Not only there, you know, like refugee camps are sometimes are better off because they are being paid by others and they don't have to pay. No, you have in whole communities like in Hebron, all the summer they are in a special regime where they get water only once a week or once a month. Yes. And Gaza, which is even a worse crime, Gaza is taken as a should be self-sufficient with the water it has on its aquifer. So in 1948, before the plight and before it was filled with refugees, there were about 80,000 or 100,000 people, and the aquifer they used from the water of the aquifer, which was about 170, if I'm correct, million cubic meter. And it's the same amount today when you have almost 2 million people. So they are supposed to be to use the same water as if they were an island separated from the rest of the country. So instead of having an agreement where Palestinians can, or when Israel, instead of the water that it steals in the West Bank, gives direct to Gaza, then they are over pumping, and they 95% of the water in Gaza is undrinkable. They have to purify everything as if, you know, like in the worst places in the third world.
Let's talk about, because we're filming this in New York, you've been teaching at NYU, you're about to go back to Ramallah, which is in the West Bank, where you have been living and reporting. How, to outsiders, do you describe not only the occupation, but the evolution of the occupation in the years that you've been covering it?
The main thing is indeed this living in enclaves, that your psyche is getting used to living in enclaves, that there is semi or false or fake or quasi-sovereignty, sense of quasi-sovereignty within the enclaves under Palestinian policing power.
Yeah, would you say there's roughly about a half dozen in the West Bank? Would we call them on these kind of Bantustans?
Let me say it's about seven. I mean, you have Gaza. I mean, you have Jenin, you have Nablus, you have Tulkarem, you have Qalqilya, you have Ramallah, you have Hebron, you have Bethlehem.
And so we should, we should be clear that one of the things the Israelis do is they make it very difficult to travel between these enclaves.
It's different. I mean, with one of the successes of the World Bank and USAID or whatever was to guarantee that there is a contiguity. There is transportational contiguity. So you can, theoretically, you can go from Jenin and you can reach Ramallah and you don't go through too many Israeli checkpoints. But at any moment, Israel can close the roads. At any moment, you can run into an Israeli soldier.
And don't they inhibit the trafficking of produce between?
Yes, but it's not as it used to be 10 years ago. This is not the issue. I mean, the issue is that you need, in order to develop, you need the space. You need the land. You need, you said the water, but not just the water. You want to build, for example, land in Ramallah is ridiculously expensive because you cannot build in other places. So land inside Ramallah became more expensive than New York in some places. Dunam, I don't know how much people pay. Maybe it's not more, but more than Tel Aviv. But you live in those enclaves and you feel that you are far 1 kilometer from an Israeli base or 3 kilometers from a settlement. And you get used to it because still it is better than living directly under Israeli occupation.
Well, you have your quisling Palestinian Authority for.
I use milder word terms. I think it's not. I don't think that they did it from the beginning so consciously as he did. I mean, let's not exaggerate. But subcontractors, yes, you have subcontractors. But also not it's not just the subcontractors, but also there is a class in Palestinian society that right now they do not see any other horizon.
Right.
So they get used to this internal.
Is the Israeli tactic to reduce Palestinians to such a draconian subsistence level that all of their energy goes into just survival within these enclaves? Is that kind of the goal?
It might be true to say about Gaza, but about the West Bank, I think it would be wrong to explain it that way. It's not such a low subsistence. I mean, it is. You have a middle class. You have opportunities to make money. You do have a growing Palestinian in certain places, bourgeoisie. You do have it. It's not. I mean, people are not on the verge of poverty, on the verge of starvation or hunger.
As we see in Gaza,
And even in Gaza. Okay, this is thanks to the world.
Yes.
And even in Gaza, I mean, you have the whole world paying money, which is hush money, in order not to force Israel to.
Let's talk about what this is. What is this done to Israeli society? I mean, when I was in Israel, which was many years ago, you had figures like Meir Kahana, the right-wing Jewish extremist, spewing racist.
He's a mainstream now.
Yes, that's exactly the point. He's mainstream now in figures like Avigdor Lieberman, even Netanyahu. What's happened? I mean, to what's happened to Israeli democracy? The Israeli state has been quite harsh with you.
With me?
Sure.
Not compared to what they do
to the Palestinians, but they've.
Yeah, it's when you said I was arrested, I was detained for a few hours. It's not. Still, I say we have democracy for Jews. It is changing, of course, but not that dramatically. Like any society that has privileges, or any group that has privileges, and it's overstepping and you want to preserve your privileges, and those who are underprivileged fight against these privileges, then you have to justify all your ways of controlling and repression by racist theories. I think this is true about many places in the world, if not all, where you have privileges. So you men have privileges, so they will develop ideas about inferiority of women in order to safeguard. And so it is, and the more we have privileges, and the more it is clear that it is at the account of the Palestinians, and the more it is at the account of any prospect for change and fairness, if not justice, in the country, the more Israeli society have to explain it by racist terms, and that these are Arabs, and they do not deserve it, and they don't need it, and they are better off with us.
Doesn't this have? I think arguably it does have ramifications internally within Israel. You're seeing, and we'll close with this increasing suppression of Israeli human rights groups, journalists such as yourself, that sure. Disease has now come back to
Israel. This is normal. I mean, in a way, maybe surprisingly late. But yes, they address the Israeli human rights organization and anti-occupation organizations, those that focus on the settlements. And the settlements embody this notion of Israeli privileges.
Right.
Of course, in the very fact that you can move there and get land for...
And that is the policy, constant building. I mean, the last time I was in East Jerusalem. The first time I was in East Jerusalem was 1988. It doesn't even look like the same city anymore.
Sure, and the West Bank. So, like a group such as Ta'ayush is a target of both the government and settlement organizations. Groups such as Breaking the Silence,
right,
which is focusing on the occupation and the settlements. So they are being targeted. Yes, and the Israelis go with it. The general Israeli public, because they are afraid. The Israeli society, Israel used to be a welfare state. Since the 70s, there was an attack on Israeli welfare state. And with the erosion of the withering away of the Israeli welfare state, there is a substitute, and this is in the occupied territory, the settlements.
There. Thank you, Amira. The Israeli religious scholar and moral philosopher Yeshayahu Leibowitz once wrote that religious nationalism is to religion what national socialism was to socialism. Leibowitz, who died in 1994, understood that the blind veneration of the military, especially after the 1967 war, where Israel captured the West Bank and East Jerusalem, was dangerous and would lead to the ultimate destruction of Israeli democracy. He foresaw, as he said, that the Arabs would be the working people, and the Jews, the administrators, inspectors, officials, and police, mainly secret police. He feared that a virulent racism would consume Israeli society. He knew that prolonged occupation of the Palestinians would spawn concentration camps for the occupied, and that, in his words, Israel would not deserve to exist, and it will not be worthwhile to preserve it.
That was a conversation with Ramira Haas and Chris Hedges, originating on the RT television program On Contact. And that is all the time we have this morning. Thank you for listening to This Week in Palestine, a weekly feature of Truth and Justice Radio. You will find us here at 90.3 FM every Sunday morning at 8 a.m. You can also stream us live on your computer at WZBC.org. We thank you for your time, and we hope you will join us again next Sunday and every Sunday. You are tuned to WZBC 90.3 FM, Newton, Massachusetts. And this is John Roberts wishing you a good morning.